and good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Writers' Voices. I'm Caroline Kilborn. My daughter Monica is not here today, but I do have a very interesting guest, one that I'm sure everybody is going to want to hear about today, especially on Veterans Day, and it's Jerry Yellen, and he is a veteran and speaks for veterans, and that's important. Jerry, welcome so much to the show.
Thank you, Caroline. It's a pleasure being here.
The book that we're going to be talking about is The Resilient Warrior, and it's about the effects that are, the things that are happening to our returning soldiers, or the ones that are over there, and then the ones that come home, and what happens to their lives and their families, and what we can do about it, hopefully help them in some way, because I have a T-shirt on that says,
Land of the free, because of the brave.
And that's what I think. That's what I believe.
Well,
I really
it's true.
Do. I know it is. I know it is. I had to wear a long shirt under it because it's so cold today. But that's, I wrote a letter to my two uncles who served in the Second World War and thanked them for doing that. Of course, I was a child then, and but I was, you know, I realized that they... service that they gave. So this is not your first book.
No, it's my fourth book.
Okay. And I think we talked about the other one, The Blackened Canteen.
Yes.
We talked about that already. So what, and then on Of War and Weddings, because you have some children who married Japanese?
I have one son, my fourth son.
Uh-huh.
He married the daughter of a kamikaze pilot. From Japan,
uh-huh.
Who was shipped out when he had 3 hours in a zero and was sent to China, but everybody in his class were killed in World War II.
Oh, golly.
So he was the only one who survived the class that he was in flying, and they only had 3 hours in a zero.
That was really something, wasn't it, that whole scenario of the kamikaze?
Well...
Of course, that's a culture thing, isn't it? Wasn't it?
Well, it was more than a culture thing. The samurai's soldiers, and this man was a samurai,
uh-huh.
Family. Their life was not their life. It belonged to the emperor, especially when they went to war.
Right.
And this was a maneuver of last resort. I was at a briefing about the invasion that was about to take place in November of 1945, and the American intelligence said that there were about 2,500 planes left in Japan. After the war, they discovered there were 12,500 planes, and their plan for the invasion, which they knew was coming, was to send 200 kamikaze planes an hour for 48 hours against the invading fleet and the invading forces.
Oh, my gosh.
So, and my squadron, the 78th Fighter Squadron, member of the 15th Fighter Group, was scheduled to be the first groups to land fighter planes in Kyushu, which is the southernmost island of Japan, had there been an invasion. But times are different today, Carolyn. There were 160 million people living in America in 1941 when the war began.
Mm-hmm.
And there were 16 million, 10% of the population, served in World War II. Today, we have 300 million people, and we have 1%, now a little bit less than 1%, of the population serving in the military. But what they're going through, what the veterans today, the Iowa National Guard, here at the Civic Center in Fairfield, had an exhibit of 74 of the young Iowa people. Not so young. They went from 19 to 54 years old.
Mm.
The Iowa National Guard people, 74 were killed. They went through three very difficult deployments. So war, for me, at 19 and 20 and 21, was the most exhilarating experience that anybody could have, because at 19 years old, I was a fighter pilot.
Yeah, right.
And give a 19-year-old a toy like the P-40 and then the P-47 and then the P-51 with a purity of purpose to kill an enemy that had attacked you.
Right.
There was nothing more exhilarating than that.
Yeah. I was always been curious about the National Guard training. These units, is that the same? They don't have the same training as a basic training when you join the Army,
well,
do they?
Well, the National Guard, I'm not familiar with where they come from, but a lot of soldiers who come back from war or come back from their enlistment when their time is up, including Annapolis graduates and West Point graduates and Air Force graduates, they join their state's National Guard, and they serve, and they stay in the reserves that way.
Well, the National Guard, of course, has always been the first line of defense for the United States, my understanding, and they're called out when there's a difficulty of some kind.
Well, I think the military itself is the first line of defense. There are permanent people in the military.
Yeah, that's true.
They're the first line of defense, and the National Guard are backups.
Okay.
This is what I know, and I'm not an expert on that.
No, you're probably right.
But we have a permanent army. During war, the draft came into being. Actually, the draft was started in 1939, 2 years of service in 1939. And there was a draft also, I believe, in World War I.
I believe so.
But today, it's an all-volunteer army.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I read statistics. There are 3.2 million people in the military now. There's 2.3 million people. 1.2 have served overseas, multiple deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Oh, I know.
And that's only 1% of the nation. Most of us don't have any feelings or really any knowledge of what war is about until you go to war, until you go into combat.
Well, we can't. We can't possibly know. And as you have said, the only people who don't suffer from war are the ones who died.
That's what Plato said before.
A long time ago.
Yeah, several thousand years ago. Only those who die are the ones who don't suffer from war. War is a debilitating experience.
Nobody wins.
Nobody wins. There are 6,100 plus Americans killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. There are 56,000 killed in Vietnam. There were 500,000 plus Americans killed in World War II. And worldwide, there were between 50 and 60 million people killed from 1937 when China went to war in Manchuria and invaded China until 1945, 8 years. There were 50 to 60 million mm-hmm. people. It's a huge amount of people who were killed. Not all of them were soldiers. The majority of them were civilians.
Right. Well, I know, of course, in Europe, there were a lot of civilians killed because of Hitler's reign and so forth. But and in Russia, under Stalin.
And in Japan. I watched on April 7th, 1945, I was part of an escort team of 125 fighter planes that left Iwo Jima, and we picked up 150 B-29s about 50 miles off the coast of Japan, and we escorted them for the first time that any land-based fighter planes flew over Japan. And I was flying high cover, about 22,000 feet, and I watched the bombers drop their bombs, little fires became bigger fires, and then square miles of Tokyo were burning. And never once did it occur to me that there were people on the ground, that there were human beings on the ground.
You become detached?
Well, in order to fight and to kill
and
to see what's going on, you have to hate somebody. You have to hate an enemy.
Yeah.
The propaganda is, hate your enemy, and no matter who it was. There's some strange thoughts ran through my mind over the years about World War II and the attack by Pearl Harbor. We have in this country then and now a very large amount of immigrants from Germany, and there were a big presence here in 1941.
Yes, there
of
were.
Germans, especially in the Midwest. And I've always doubted that we would have declared war on Germany after we attacked Pearl Harbor. But 8 days after Pearl Harbor, the biggest mistake that Adolf Hitler made he declared war on the United States. So we didn't have to put that to the test.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of an interesting subject to talk about,
it is.
To think about. But the reality of it is that we went to a world war, and it was necessary.
And the whole country pulled together.
Yes, the whole country
pulled together. I can remember that. I can remember rationing.
Oh, yeah.
And,
Well, they stopped packaging Lucky Strike cigarettes in tin foil. And
right.
Lucky Strike went to war, they said. It was aluminum pots and steel. And the Japanese were pretty smart in the 30s. We were exporters in those days. And one of our best customers was Japan.
Mm-hmm.
We shipped them most of the oil that they had. We shipped them a great deal of scrap iron that they turned around and made into munitions and warships and battleships and tanks and everything. And they were bent on being the masters of the Pacific Rim. The greater co-prosperity sphere is what they called their plans. Asians for Asians. And America had a presence, and the Netherlands had a presence in Asia, and mm-hmm. England, and all of the larger countries had a presence, and they felt that it was wrong. And most of the leaders of the Japanese military before the war studied in American universities.
Well, where did Japan get their oil and so
from
forth?
From America.
Then? But after they attacked us, then where did they get it? We certainly didn't keep sending it to them.
They literally attacked us, much to the chagrin of the naval commander Yamamoto, who went to Harvard and had a lot of friends in America. What happened in 1940, we wanted Japan to get out of China. And Chiang Kai-shek and his wife, Madam Chiang, who was American educated, came to the United States and prevailed on President Roosevelt to help them rid China of Japan. And so President Roosevelt issued an ultimatum to Japan that if they didn't get out of China, there was going to be an embargo. We were going to embargo.
Ah.
We stopped shipping steel. We stopped shipping raw iron. And we'll embargo, stop shipping them oil, of course, from America.
Mm-hmm.
But we were going to put an embargo around Japan and not let any shipping come in.
From anywhere?
From anywhere. We were going to.
Okay.
And they had maybe 2 years of supplies on hand to fight a war. And the Japanese literally took that as not as a bargaining chip, but took it as the word that was going to happen. And their military people, army mostly, were in charge, and they got together and said, if we knock out all their ships, they can't do an embargo. So they initiated plans in 1940 to bomb Pearl Harbor if they couldn't negotiate something. Now, there was the Prime Minister of Japan. I know his name, but I can't say it at the moment. I can't think about it. He was a cousin of the Emperor, was told by the Emperor to negotiate with President Roosevelt, and they were willing to do three things. They were willing to get out of China. They were really willing to stop the war in Indonesia, where they were,
mm-hmm.
and they were willing to break their pact with Germany and with Italy, the tribe.
Oh, okay.
They were willing to do that. And they tried to negotiate a meeting with President Roosevelt, but the Secretary of State, Hull, intercepted all of this, because in September of 1944, when all of this was going on, Roosevelt's mother died. So he was not really available. And Cordell Hull, who felt he'd been shut out with a lot of the negotiations that were going on all over between America and other places. So he made preconditions for the Japanese. before he would sit down and meet with them.
Ah.
And the preconditions were exactly the three things that the Japanese were willing to do. Get out of China, stop the war in Indonesia, and break their pact with Germany and with Italy. That was in 1944. That was in 1940.
40, yeah.
And Hull insisted that that be put on the table beforehand, so there would be no negotiations. And the Japanese didn't buy that. And
They would have done it, but they wanted to.
But they wanted to negotiate it. This is what they would negotiate.
They
were pretty smart. America had already broken their code in 1940. Every diplomatic message came back. You know, America read. All of this is historical fiction that I wrote in the book called The Blackened Canteen when I did research. So it's fairly fresh in my mind. It was not something that I knew when I was 17 years old in 1941.
Yeah, I certainly never heard this before.
Yeah,
I mean,
well, it's historically correct, been researched. I know that because when I came back in 2006 from a ceremony that was held on top of Mount Shizuhata in Japan for 23, a Japanese ceremony for 23 Americans who were killed in two B-29s crashed on June 20th at 1-2 o'clock in the morning in 1945, and 23 Americans were killed. So when I came back from that ceremony in 2006, I said, this story has to be told. There was a canteen with the handprint of the man who was holding it, the American, and it was found by a Mr. Ito, who took the remains and buried them in a common grave. And then after the war, after he got out of jail, he was arrested, of course, and lost his business, lost his farm, became a Buddhist priest. And then he erected a monument on top of Mount Shizuhatu and conducted a ceremony using this blackened canteen. I had to write that book. So I knew a professor from a school in New Jersey, Paul Zigo, and I called Paul and I said, Paul, I would like to ask you a favor. He says, what is it? He said, would you please get some of your students to do some research of what the temperament of the country of Japan was in 1939, 1940, before Pearl Harbor, 1941? He says, funny you should ask. He says, my thesis for my master's degree is 120 pages called The Failed Meeting Between Prince Konoye, who was the prime minister, and Cordell Hull, or President Roosevelt, that could have prevented Pearl Harbor. So he had 120 pages of statistical evidence documented as a thesis for his master's degree. And he gave that to me to use in the book, The Blackened Canteen.
Uh-huh.
So what I'm quoting to you
is
documented and authoritative facts.
Well, I had seen somewhere, I don't know whether it might, maybe it was fiction, but it was in a movie, that there was a message sent to the War Department, I don't know who from, but that this attack was imminent, but it was misdirected, and so it never got to the proper people to warn the fleet so they could go out to sea.
I was thinking that that was for Pearl Harbor, that they knew, but they didn't know that that was imminent. There was talk that Roosevelt knew about it, President Roosevelt knew about it, but there's evidence that shows that that was not so.
Right.
But they knew that something was up.
Something was up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They had codes broken, but there was no communications between the branches of the service, and there was no communications between the branches of the government, the people that did know.
Mm-hmm.
So
I
would imagine that there's a lot that we don't know about any of the wars.
Oh, of course.
That go on, things that go on.
Yeah. I have been reading a book, the Untold Stories of World War II, of all the different things that happened, you know, about some of the Nazi movement in the United States and, you know, different things and how they camouflaged the Lockheed plant in California, put a tarp over the top of it and camouflaged it so Japanese planes wouldn't know that it was an aircraft plant. That's amazing.
Well, there are a lot of things that are amazing. I think the most amazing thing is that of the 16 million of us who served in World War II, there are now less than a million left mm-hmm. in the United States. And statistically, we're leaving this world for points unknown at the rate of 50 to 60,000 a month. Mm. So in another year, there'll be a handful of veterans left. I was one of the younger guys going in 2 months after Pearl Harbor on my 18th birthday, and I'll be 88 in February. I don't think there's anybody left in the 78th Fighter Squadron. I flew with 16 guys who didn't come back, but there aren't too many that can walk and talk today.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Iwo Jima for the 65th anniversary in 2010, and I've been invited to go back again in 2012. One general who died as a general, Fred Haynes, was a captain, as I was a captain on Iwo Jima, and he died last year. And his wife, Bonnie Haynes, his name was Fred Haynes, he was a three-star general, went to Iwo Jima this year, 2011, in March, and they landed on Guam the day that the tsunami hit Japan.
Oh, my goodness.
So the trip was called off.
Uh-huh.
And next, 2012, probably be the last time that anybody other than the Japanese military goes to Iwo Jima. There's going to be a big ceremony on the beach. They're going to bury Fred Haynes' ashes in the black sands where his buddies died. This is what his wish was.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think the most famous picture from the war is the raising of the flag.
It is.
Yeah.
I was not there. The flag went up. They invaded on the 29th, on the 19th of February. And I stood on the spot in 2010 where on February 22nd, 27th, the flag was raised. We landed there on March 7th, 1945. They had just taken the dirt airstrip. And we flew in on March 7th, straight for the Marines. And it's a remarkable island when you think about it. It's 8 square miles of land, 650 miles from Tokyo, 650 miles from Guam, Saipan, and Tinian. And there were 90,000 soldiers fighting at the same time on 8 square miles of land.
That is amazing.
There were 28,000 young people killed, 21,000 Japanese, and 7,000 American Marines, 6,800 and change, nearly 7,000. And the sights and the sounds and the smells, I can see them and hear them and smell it right now as I'm sitting here. It never goes away. When I landed my airplane, I saw mounds and mounds and mounds of dead Japanese bodies being pushed into mass graves.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't disturb me at all, but behind my squadron area was the Marine mortuary with truck after truck loaded up with dead American Marines laid out for identification and burial. So it was a debilitating time, aside from being an exciting time. And those of us who go into combat always feel nothing's going to happen to us. It's going to be the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
And with all that hatred, in 1988 I went to a wedding, and now I have 3 Japanese grandchildren, 121, 120, and 115.
Yeah. We should really probably get to the premise of your book.
Which, yeah, okay.
Although, I mean, I could listen to you talk about this, you know, the whole program. But the premise of this book is, of course, that TM can help the veterans who are suffering.
Well, we've found there's a lot of research. The National Institute of Health over the last 50 years has given $26 million to research what transcendental meditation is. There are a lot of people who have misthoughts, the wrong thoughts about transcendental meditation. And
yes, there are.
They talk about it as a philosophy. They talk about it as a religion. And they talk about it as a belief and talk about it as a cult, following the teachings of one person, which is a cult, following the teachings of a person.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't any of that. And The only way that I can explain it to the military guys that I talk to, and I speak to lots and lots of military guys today with Operation Warrior Wellness, I ask them a question. Have you ever had a zone experience? Now, every athlete at one point in time has a zone experience. I had zone experiences when I flew fighter missions against and flew air-to-air combat against the Japanese in 1945. I literally shot down four Japanese airplanes. Three of them were listed as probables. One of them, the guy bailed out and almost landed on my airplane, so that was a confirmed kill. And all that I can tell you about those moments in the air, flying 300 or 400 miles an hour and shooting down airplanes, was that I saw the airplane and I saw the results of what I did. Nothing in between. I became the airplane. I was in the zone. After the war, I became a very good golfer, addictive golfer. This was my escape from me, from my experiences in the war. And there were many, many days when I went out and I was completely, completely in charge of that golf club. I was the golf club.
You're in the zone.
In the zone. Anything that I thought, I did. In the zone. Tiger Woods probably is one of the best golfers that ever lived. And in an interview, he said, there are key shots that I made in major tournaments where the only thing that I remember is taking the club out of the bag and seeing the ball land on the green. Yogi Berra was asked, what do you think about when you're hitting? He said, can you think and hit at the same time? And Bobby Jones, the great amateur golfer, said, when I play good golf, I think a little. When I play great golf, I don't think at all. So meditation, transcendental meditation, is not what you think. If it was what you think, if what you think influenced your behavior in sports, then everybody would be a great athlete because they just have to think the thoughts that make them into great things. I want to hit this shot. I want to throw this pitch. I want to make a touchdown. I want to do a... But it's not what you think. It's how the brain functions that gets you into the zone. And what the brain does, it shuts down the intellect, not the thinking, but shuts down the intellect. Time slows down, so everything is like slow motion. And when I was flying very fast, everything seemed to be in slow motion. And motion becomes effortless and fluid. When you meditate, you have a mantra, a word, that is meaningless. It means nothing. But what it allows you to do 20 minutes a day, twice a day, is get the entire brain functioning coherently as if you're in the zone in an athletic event. It's not what you think, it's how you think. All of us have the same magical powers that we can't control. We can't control the liver, we can't control our heart, we can't control... These are mechanical things. In the words of today, the body is hardware. And we put software in, which are the thoughts, the religious thoughts, and the philosophy thoughts, the belief thoughts. Those are the software. But we don't do that in transcendental meditation. Transcendental meditation lets the brain settle down so thoughts come from a deeper level and you have the body at rest and you have the greatest mind-body coordination 20 minutes twice a day. That's what TM is.
Well, when Maharishi was here, and I can't remember the year, but I worked for the KMCD then, and my husband and I went to meet him and interviewed him. My husband asked him, is it a religion? And Maharishi said, I could have made it a religion if I had wanted to, but I did not.
Well, I don't know how you make a religion. What you do, people make the religion. People follow other people, make a religion. Religion is a wonderful thing for those who believe.
Yeah.
And it's a helpmate. But religion cannot take away the stress that you have from war, period. The treatment for stress is antidepressant drugs, for antipsychotic drugs, from long, long years of psychiatry, and it's not available to the veterans. About 3 months ago, 2 months ago, there was a story, a front page story in the Des Moines Register, headlined "The War on PTSD," and the story of an Afghan soldier who came back, who had tried to shoot himself to get an injury while he was in Afghanistan, member of the Iowa National Guard, and then came home, and he tried to kill himself. He was a member of the Sheriff's Department of Story County. He lost his job because he was told he wasn't fit to carry a gun, had marital problems, had two children. And I called him on the Monday after I read that paper, and he came down here to Fairfield with his wife, Abby, and stayed at the Mainstay for 3 nights and learned how to meditate. And you cannot believe the letters that I have received from him.
Changed his life.
Yeah, unbelievable change of life. Thanks me profusely. I don't need any thanks. I suffered from post-traumatic stress, undiagnosed, for 30 years. For 30 years, I had an addictive behavior on the golf course. I played golf 3 or 4 times a week. I moved 15 to 18 times. I couldn't hold a job. And I was married, had 4 children, had a loving wife, and they went through the same thing. I didn't know I was
Didn't know you were sick.
I didn't know that everybody wasn't like me.
How did you find TM?
Helene, listen, in 1975, Maharishi was on Merv Griffin's show.
Mm-hmm.
And Helene watched that show. And she said, I have to learn how to meditate. So Stephen, our second son, who was here in Fairfield, was number one player at the University of Pennsylvania, was going to Europe to play in home-and-home series with Oxford and Cambridge and St. Andrews, a few other colleges, and then they were going to stay for Wimbledon. And he said to his mother, he says, wait for me, Mom. I want to learn, too, when I come back. So in July, Stephen and Helene learned Transcendental Meditation. And then in August of 1975, I learned. And it was a life-changing experience. I know some of the videos that we have at TM.org or the David Lynch Foundation.org show veterans from Vietnam, Dan Burks, veterans from Iraq, David George, Ron Carr. These people learned TM early on and got their life back. And David George's mother has a short video that talks about her getting her son back from wherever he was, mm-hmm. David George. And it's something that works. It works on every brain exactly the same. It's not what you think. It's how the brain reacts to the mantra, to what you learn. And what it does medically is incredible, without drugs. We have stories. We taught 6 soldiers from the Wounded Warrior Project in New York City, TM, 2 or 3 months ago. One soldier, Lou, and I can't think of his last name, came home from Iraq and locked himself in his house and in his room for 1 year. He never went out. Mm. And then he was asked if he wanted to learn Transcendental Meditation, and reluctantly he came from New York to New York City near Penn Station to the Wounded Warrior office, and he learned TM. And now it's 2 months later, and he's enrolled in college, back into college.
Goodness.
Stories like this across the country. We were in Minnesota not too long ago, and there was a Vietnam veteran, not an Iraqi veteran, sitting between a Vietnam veteran and the man, Arm Thompson, who's in charge of reentry programs for the Wisconsin National Guard. And they all learned how to do Transcendental Meditation. 30 people up there, 30 veterans. And it works. That's all I can tell you. It works.
Well, there's a program. I saw this on a program on TV about Operation Proper Exit. Have you heard about that?
No, I have not.
That's where they take some of these guys back, because when they left, they were unconscious.
Oh, I saw it on 60 Minutes.
Yeah, that was it, 60 Minutes.
Well, that's 63 guys in 2 or 3 years, 8 fellas on this. Oh, that's 8 guys. You know, there's a million, there's 600,000 or 700,000 known cases of post-traumatic stress.
Right.
They took the disorder, the D off, the disorder, in the military. There's 600,000 or 700,000 known. There are an equal amount, who do not want to admit, or they do not want to hinder their careers. There's a stigma attached to mental disease.
Right.
And this is not a disease. It's stress. It's just plain the after effects of stress. And Dr. Oz, who learned how to meditate 3 years ago, just had his entire production staff learn meditation.
Good for
and
him.
And he said, on the back of the hidden, of the resilient warrior, he made this blurb: stress causes anger, depression, and violent behavior, and transcendental meditation removes stress.
Mm-hmm.
That's as simple a statement as you can make.
Right.
Well, if you have stress, you need something to get rid of the stress. It can either be drugs, it can either be alcohol, it can be recreational drugs, it can be addictive golf, something to get rid of stress.
Well, the drugs don't really work, though.
They don't. This fellow Lou had 19 drugs that he was taking.
Oh, my God.
He's drug-free today. I have a guy, Norman, somebody from Vietnam, 66 years old, and he has CROP, asthma, problems sleeping, and 2 months after, he learned transcendental meditation. And I have this in writing. 2 months after he learned to meditate, he's off all of his drugs, including his sleeping pills, and he feels on a scale of 1 to 10, he started out as a 2, he's now an 8, and he's 66 years old, and he can't wait to play flag football again. He's out running around in the garden. He's with his grandchildren. He was sitting in a chair all day long. So those are some of the, just, you know, a few of the stories.
Yeah.
There's a veteran learned in Washington, D.C. He actually couldn't sit through the lecture, the introductory lecture of transcendental meditation. He had a lot of shrapnel in his body, and he was in pain.
Mm.
And the first day that he was meditating on his own, the first day, he started to meditate at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and he woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning. He went to sleep, and he slept pain-free for the first time since he'd been injured in the war. These story after story after story. It works. That's the best I can say.
Well,
it works.
You know, there's so many things that don't work, and this is an obvious need for veterans, both male and female.
Yes.
And so, you know, if it works.
There's a lady in California, in San Diego, California, by the name of Tara Wise, W-I-S-E, who learned to meditate on Monday of this week. Today's Friday. On Tuesday morning, she called me at 6 o'clock in the morning and said, "Jerry, what happened to me? I slept all night for the first time. I have so much energy. What is this doing to me? What is this?" She was elated. She knows of 30,000+ women, veterans, who have been sexually abused in the military in San Diego.
Mm.
The same amount in San Francisco, the same amount in Los Angeles. She's 39 years old, and she's a veteran. And we hooked up. She learned how to meditate. She founded the National Women's Veterans Association of America. And she's going to be standing with me at a press conference on December 2nd in Los Angeles, and on the stage at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art with Ellen DeGeneres and Russell Brand and David Lynch and Russell Simmons and Paul Reichart, who is the president of the Iraqi-Afghanistan Veterans Association, who's going to receive a reward. I will be presenting that award because I won it last year for the first time. And we're going to give it to him this time. And we're going to announce that transcendental meditation is available to the veterans who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
That's through the David Lynch Foundation?
Through the David Lynch Foundation, through a division of the David Lynch Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
They take care of the American Indians, the homeless, the incarcerated, and children at risk. And then we started Operation Warrior Wellness. So it's a specific division.
Okay.
And the funds will go to this division, to Operation Warrior Wellness. Any money that we raise in Iowa, I'm trying very hard to get companies just starting this to ask their employees to volunteer 1 hour of their pay a month for 12 months so that we can have enough money through employee donations to Operation Warrior Wellness to offer Transcendental Meditation to all the Iowa National Guard and all the veterans who need it in Iowa, keep the money in Iowa. We're going to try and do that in every state, and we're trying to do the national things. One of the great things that happened last week is the fire commissioner of New York City learned to meditate. He learned last Monday. And on Tuesday, he said to his driver, if you see me sitting in a back seat with my eyes closed, don't try to wake me. I'm not sleeping. I'm meditating.
Mm.
And then yesterday, the code talkers from World War II and the fire commissioner and Ray Kelly, the police commissioner in New York, and other dignitaries had a ceremony, and the fire commissioner couldn't stop talking about meditation. Hopefully, we'll be able to offer it for nothing through donations in New York City to the entire fire department of New York City and to the surviving members of those who were killed in 9/11 10 years ago. That's our goal.
Well, those firefighters who responded on 9/11, I'm sure those that survived have a great deal of stress in
there. Yeah, you know, nature works in a very strange way. When I was on Iwo Jima, I met a fellow from Brooklyn, New York, a Vietnam veteran, command sergeant major in the Marines and in the Air Force, retired Ed Schloman, 70 years old, 69 years old. And he's my co-chair of Operation Warrior Wellness. So he learned how to meditate 5 or 6 months ago, maybe even longer, he and his wife Judy. And he got to the fire commissioner and taught to talk to him about mm-hmm. learning Transcendental Meditation. And he learned this week. On the way into the fire commissioner's office, there was a barricade that comes down. And the barricade came down on his car, on Ed Schloman's car, destroyed the front of the car. Ed Schloman has a son, Robert, who's a lieutenant in the police department. And there was a sergeant there in charge of the accident. And he said to Ed, what are you doing here? He says, I'm going to see the fire commissioner. He says, what are you going to see him about? He says, well, we're going to give him an introductory lecture to Transcendental Meditation so overcome post-traumatic stress. This he said to the sergeant, just somebody that he was there for the accident.
Mm-hmm.
And the sergeant said, here's my sister Emily's telephone number. You have to call her. She's making a film called Code 9. It seems that Code 9 is a code word for the police departments to call when there's an officer in trouble. And she has an 8-minute trailer about post-traumatic stress disorder in the fire departments, in the police departments of every country, of every city in America. And so now we're partnering with her to make this this documentary. And Luke Jensen from Iowa, because of who he was, a sheriff, and what he learned, TM, he will probably be the spokesman for that. So we're going out into the general public, too,
mm-hmm.
to relieve stress. The police departments have been cut back. They're working
right.
longer hours.
Right.
Fire departments, school teachers. It's amazing. When
yeah.
Oprah came here, she told someone at the university, and I'm quoting her when she came here a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
She said, everywhere that I go in the world and speak to children, I am the inspiration for those children. But when I meditated here in the school with the children here, they were an inspiration to me. That's what she said. So it's mainstream. It's going to be mainstream. And it should be mainstream for those who are willing to take an hour a day for 5 days in a row to learn how to meditate properly. and then 20 minutes a day, twice a day, for the rest of their lives, and feel stress-free living.
So how do we overcome this this idea that you look down on if you have mental illness? How do we overcome that? Because it's
this isn't a mental illness. This is
no, but I mean the guys that won't admit that they have the
you have to tell them. I've been invited to go speak to the Air Force Academy. First time around, I'm going to be at a forum on February 24th for 3 days. And then I'll be invited back before the summer to speak to the cadets. All I'm going to tell them is my zone experiences as an athlete, my zone experiences as a pilot,
mm-hmm.
and what happens when you're in the zone, how life becomes effortless, how thoughts become clearer, how your relationships with people are better. Everything's improving when you don't have any stress in your body, when the mind-body connection is together. Everything improves. And this is a technique, a non-religious, non-philosophical, non-belief system of a mechanical way to connect the mind and the body. That's as simple as it can be stated.
Mm-hmm.
$26 million worth of research. There are many, many, many forms of meditation. But there are some meditations where you say a word over and over. That's concentration. That's not what you want to do. You want to have free flow.
Mm-hmm.
There are some meditations, you look at a light or a flickering
mm-hmm.
flame. That's concentration. That's the opposite of what you're supposed to, what happens when you let the mind flow, when it becomes more coherent, when all the prefrontal cortex in sports is the CEO of the brain. This is Dr. Fred Travis now. A research physician talking, or a scientist talking. He said, when you practice and you practice and you practice, the prefrontal cortex grabs that knowledge, and when you do something athletically, if there's no stress in what you're doing, if you don't have to make a shot, or you don't have to make a basket, or you don't have to throw a strike, and that thought's in your mind, then the message goes directly to the motor system, and you're effortless. But if there's any hesitation, if there's any distraction in your mind, then the prefrontal cortex takes over and intercepts the signal, and you stiffen up. You choke.
Uh-huh.
Choke. That's what choking is. It's got nothing to do with the physical. It has to do with the mental. They say muscle memory. Muscles don't have memory. Only the mind has memory. And the mind remembers everything. Major, major, major athletes in every situation have choked on easy things because they were thinking ahead to the results of what they were going to do.
Okay? Yeah.
We are responsible for our actions, for every action. There isn't one human being that can predict the results of their action. Not one. I'll give you an example. A baseball pitcher in a baseball game throws a pitch, and he said, boy, that's a perfect pitch. That's a strike. The batter sees the ball coming. He says, I can hit that. And he slams it. And he says, home run, as he starts to trot around. And the outfielder sees the ball coming and runs, climbs up the wall, catches the ball. And the guy on third base says, I can beat the throw. And he beats the throw, slides safely, but the umpire calls him out. So you have a pitcher, a batter, an outfielder, and a runner. All did perfect things. Not one of them got the result that they expected. So all that we can do in our lives is take action, but we cannot predict the results of it. I can predict the results of meditation being a beautiful 20 minutes a day, twice a day, at rest. Deep rest makes the day go clearer, makes it much less stressful. You'll always have stress, much less stressful. And everybody should be able to read what Abby Jensen said about her life, who was the wife of a guy who tried to kill himself, military guy, in 2009.
There are a lot of suicides now in the military, aren't there?
There were more suicides in 2011 so far than there were than soldiers were killed in combat.
Oh my gosh!
238 or 248 soldiers committed suicide, not counting the helpline for suicide in the Veterans Department got 700,000 calls or more for suicide calls from the military. It's devastating, absolutely devastating.
What a waste.
It's a waste. It's
absolutely
a waste. We don't have to talk about, was it right to go to war? Was it not right to go to war? Those are decisions for other people. The veterans need our help. Imagine it costs $750 for us to teach a veteran. Fee is $1,500, but we have matching funds for the veterans. So for every $750, we can teach a veteran or his family member, and they should be taught together. Wives, sisters, brothers, families should be taught for a lifetime of health. And some guys are taking more than $750 a month in drugs, and they're not getting any help.
Right.
So there's an economic thing, there's a moral thing, there's a thing that is...
It's a practical thing.
Practical thing, it works. And that's what Transcendental Meditation is. It's a technique. It's a warrior's training. If anybody has seen the film, The Last Samurai, there's a scene in the rain where Tom Cruise, who plays a guy in Japan, and a warrior, Japanese warrior, fighting with kendo sticks. And Tom Cruise is getting knocked into the mud and knocked into the ground and hit upon. And a little 8 or 9 year old, 10 year boy, Japanese boy, who speaks English, is saying to him, too much mind, no mind, no mind. And then you see Tom Cruise character get it. And he goes on equal stature fighting this expert with the kendo. And there comes a time when he's attacked by 5 or 6 Japanese men in the streets, wherever the city was, Cruise alone, and you could see his face go into silence, and he's able to handle and do what he has to do. It's that silence of the mind that allows the samurai warrior to be the samurai warrior. It's allowed all the martial arts from 5,000 years ago to come down. And this meditation, TM, is a 5,000-year-old warrior modality. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. And anybody who does martial arts has better days. Anybody who plays golf has better days.
Sure.
Anybody who plays tennis. Bill Russell, one of the great basketball players, talks about the flow of energy of being in the zone and what a magical experience it is to have that. And when all 5 guys on a basketball court on the same team have that, it's like no other experience in the world. I've had those moments in 3 different disciplines, one as a fighter pilot, one as a scratch golfer representing America in an international golf tournament, and then again as a writer when I sat down to write my books. There were times when I just sat there and then I finished 30 minutes or 40 minutes or 2 hours later and I read and I said, where did that come from? I couldn't possibly have written that. Where did it come from? I wasn't there. I was everything.
Okay, the Resilient Warrior is, of course, available locally here in
yes.
Fairfield. Is it on Amazon and those places?
It's on Amazon. It's I don't know if it's on Kindle yet, but it's on Amazon. All 4 of my books you can get at Amazon.
And you're going to be there. You're going to be at Revelations for a book signing. When is that going to be?
It's a week from tomorrow. It's Saturday the 19th from 2 to 4.
Okay.
And we're going to do a different kind of book signing. I'm hoping that I'm doing the right thing. We're not going to ask any money for the books, but we are going to ask for a donation, tax-free donation, to the David Lynch Foundation, Operation Warrior Wellness. And all of the funds raised will go towards teaching Iowa veterans and their families Transcendental Meditation.
Okay.
I'll be talking about the reasons why the books were written, about the books, and I'll sign the books. And all of the funds will go towards helping veterans and their families.
We didn't talk about the co-author here, Dr. Serena
Grosswald.
Grosswald?
Well, Dr. Grosswald is a scientist. She's got her PhD. She's been a TM teacher for many, many years, and she is the scientific director of Operation Warrior Wellness. And there are about 15 or 20 pages of research that she put together that's in the back of the book, research about transcendental meditation.
Yeah, because they've been researching that for a long time.
40 years.
Yeah.
40 years.
Yeah. I moved here. I grew up in Iowa, but then I moved back here from Pennsylvania in 72. And I believe in 73, they bought the campus and started, you know, TM came to Fairfield.
Well, for me, they made a big mistake. They should have stayed in Santa Barbara.
Oh,
not really.
Oh, no.
I flew with five guys out of 32 guys from Iowa. 32 squad guys in our squadron, 34 guys. Five of them were from Iowa. Three of them graduated with my class. Two of them didn't come back, Howard Edmondson and Al Sharon from Waterloo. Al was killed on the 8th of July over Tokyo in a P-51. He called in and he said, I'm hit and I can't see, and he was gone. And Pudgy Carr was also killed on that day. He was my tent mate on Iwo Jima.
And that's another thing that happens, because you are your brother's in arms.
Oh yes.
And it's something that unless you experience that, you really don't understand it.
I have to say that your fighting for your country goes out the window when you're in combat. The only people who are important are the guys next to you, your buddies, your pals. And I lost 16 of them in the war, 11 in combat, 5 in training in Hawaii. But it's your buddies that are important.
So you can see why that adds to the stress pack.
Well, that's what happened with this young guy who killed himself in 2010, early 2010. He was on patrol in Bosnia with a buddy, his best friend next to him on patrol.
Mm-hmm.
He spotted a sniper, and he pulled his gun up and pointed it at the sniper, and for a fraction of a second he froze. He didn't pull because of what he was thinking, which nobody will ever know, but he froze on the trigger enough time for the sniper to get off a round and kill his buddy, and then Dari pulled the trigger and he killed this guy. And then he came home and he started to think, and he took the responsibility of his buddy being killed.
Mm-hmm.
And so he drank and he went and used drugs, became a drug dealer, and finally, 8 years after he came home, he took his life. Stress.
Mm-hmm. Suffered all that time.
Stress, yeah.
Yeah.
He just had to find ways of getting rid of the stress. Alcohol doesn't get rid of it.
No.
Marijuana.
It only makes it worse, doesn't
it? Yeah, it exacerbates it.
The, right.
We need our own tools. And transcendental meditation is just a tool.
Right.
It's just something that you do as a tool to relieve stress. And the less you think about the benefits of meditating, the more benefits you get. Less is more. Absolutely, less is more. You don't do it to get something. You do it because it's the right thing for your physiology. It's the right thing for your mind, and clarify your mind. It's the right thing for your body. You get deep rest. So you don't do it to get anything. You do it because it's good for you, and it helps you. And the side effect is you get over stress, your benefits of relationships are better, clarity of thought is good in business, decision-making is better, it's good in business. So it's a practical thing for a better way of life.
If our listeners, if you know a veteran that you know is suffering, or you are a veteran who's suffering, tell them about this book. And it's not a very big book. It reads very easily. The Resilient Warrior by Jerry Yellen. And you will thank him forever.
Well,
you thank TM forever.
We don't need thanks. We just want. We don't need anything.
No, but it is great. And thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you, Caroline.
Really appreciate it.
Enjoyed being here
on this Veterans Day.
Thank you.
11/11/11.
Another 1,000 years, we'll have it again.
Right. Stay tuned for James Moore and his outstanding program, and we will see you next week. Bye bye.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.